Hello everyone, and welcome into the TakeCast. My name is Davis Matic. You guys can find me on Twitter at Davis Matic. In this episode of the show, I am joined by Michael Price, a current writer for The Simpsons, who started, more towards the golden days. His first episode was in season 13, and he is still a writer for the show. He also has a show on Netflix called F is for Family, and has writing credits, just sort of all around the filmmaking industry. And you guys know, I love The Simpsons. We've done, multiple episodes covering our favorite sports episodes. It's just something that Pat Mayo and I talk about all the time when he comes on the show. So you guys know that this really was kind of a dream for me to be able to get someone from the show onto the podcast. I think that enthusiasm shows through on my part, and Michael was, just a fantastic guest. I thought he had a lot of great answers, a lot of really interesting anecdotes about working on the show and working on television in general. Of course, we are sponsored by RotoExperts.com. You can get 10% off of the best fantasy football projections, rankings, and analysis for a full year. So if you sign up today, you get it for a full another year for $39.99, and you can get 10% off of that using the promo code MATTEK, M-A-T-T-E-K. You can also get bonus episodes of the show on Patreon, patreon.com/TakeCast. And of course, I would have really appreciated if you would leave a rating and review on iTunes. That really helps out the show and, just makes it easier for me to keep getting great guests like Michael. Now, without further ado, let's get into the show. All right, everyone, would love to welcome in Michael Price to the show. Michael is a former writer of The Simpsons. He has a show on Netflix right now, F for Family, that I believe was just renewed for a fourth season. And he is gracious enough to share some of his time during his busy work week to come on the show and talk to us about what it's like to work on the greatest show in American history. How you doing, Michael?
Hey, I'm good, Davis. One slight correction. I am still a writer on The Simpsons.
Still a writer. Okay.
So I have a very unique situation, which has been very wonderful. The Simpsons has been so nice to me. I've been here at The Simpsons for 18 years almost since the end of 2001. And they let me take time off a couple of months every year or so to go work on F is for Family and then come back. So,
well, I mean, pretty good deal.
Yeah. Very good. They've been very, very nice. So, but I'm actually talking to you right now from my office here at The Simpsons today.
Wow. This is, there's been a lot of people that I really admire and who I really like on this show, but this is probably the most excited I've ever been to sit down and do an episode. So the first thing I just have to ask you, as someone who's been a fan of the show as long as I can remember, what is your favorite episode of the show from before your time, or maybe just one that you didn't write?
Well, it's both. So my favorite episode of all time is from season probably 6 or 7, which is the Poochie show, Itchy and Scratchy and Poochie.
Itchy, it's good because that one's about writing TV.
Yeah, it's that. It's about Krusty. It's about the TV the writers who write the Itchy and Scratchy. It's got all that great, you guys know how great it is. So it's just something about it. It's just a perfect episode. I love it. I love it so much. It's quoted endlessly. It's such a great episode.
Yeah, that was I would say that's probably one of my 10 favorites. It's like at a certain point it is kind of hard to it is kind of hard to choose. Okay, so what is your favorite that you wrote?
Well, I guess I have two, because there's one that I could say that's the most personally interesting to me, a most personally close connection, is one I wrote about 10 years ago that is called E Pluribus Wiggum. And I think we wrote it in 2008, right?
So that's good memory. Yeah, 2008.
Because it had to do with the presidential election, and it has to do with the presidential primary coming to Springfield, and it ends with Ralph Wiggum being kind of against his will, as a joke originally, being drafted as a write-in candidate for president, and then he ends up winning. But the reason I love the episode, but the reason that it has a personal connection to me is that my son, who's now 20 years old, was 10 years old or so when we were writing it, and I spent a lot of time hang out with him while I was working on it, and he was just getting into the show at that time, and so he came up with a bunch of ideas for jokes that he threw at me, and and I used a couple, and they got into the show. So,
there you go.
Yeah, specifically the area, the beginning of the episode is all about Homer discovering very convenient garbage can at Krusty Burger that you can, you know, throw your garbage away while sitting in the car. And that's based on a thing that he and I found while we were driving one day. We found a Burger King like that. And I said, wow, this is great. We'll throw all our junk at it from the car. And he goes, Homer would really like that.
He would.
So it turned into a whole, as we call our act one set piece, you know, is all about that. So that's why I love that episode.
That's pretty interesting because in my I've obviously listened to podcasts about the show and listened to Matt Groening and Bill and Josh and Mike Scully all talk about the show. How much of what ends up in the show would you say is related to what the writers or the showrunners, the producers are kind of going through in their actual daily lives? Because I've seen. Well, my sense is that the correlation between the two things is kind of higher than you would imagine from the outside.
Yeah, I'd say that's true. I mean, because any writer, anyone, even if you're writing Star Wars or whatever, you know, you're trying to filter, you're bringing ideas and you're bringing stuff from your own experience into it. So, and, you know, especially with a show, The Simpsons has been on for so long and we're upwards of 660 episodes or more, you know, we're always trying to find something different, something new, unique. So, I'd say a lot of stuff comes from our everyday experience, from our relationships with our family or, you know, with our wives or like something that happened while we were driving down the street. So this one particularly, that part really is very close. A couple other episodes I've written have come from other observations, you know, of myself, of my son, my relationship with my mom and my dad. Yeah, quite a bit, I'd say.
How has the process of writing an episode changed as, you know, just the whole workforce really, and this is true of everything has just become more digitized. It's a lot easier to, you know, communicate ideas via email. You and I are having this conversation over a conference call software. You know, we're 1500 miles apart. I know, you know, some of the actors, they don't read their lines in the same room anymore. You know, they're calling their stuff in. So how is the process of writing episodes change as it's become easier to do things from different places?
Yeah, I wouldn't say the writing process per se, like the initial writing process has changed all that much because it still is based on an idea that we have that a writer will have that will then pitch to Al Jean, our head writer, and or get with Matt Groening or Jim Brooks. And then we write a script and then we all work on the script together. That basic process of how the show is written hasn't changed that much appreciably in all the years I've been here. But it's the producing of it that's, you're very true, very right, that has changed in terms of, you know, the production of it. You know, when I started on the show, it was towards the tail end of using cells. So
right.
my first season I worked on was season 13. Was on the air. And so that's the last season where they used actual cell animation. And so after that, then it went to more digital work. And then, but still there was like kind of hand paintedness and then it all went digital around 11, 12 years ago, around the same time as the movie came out. So that's all changed. It's easier to sort of change some things. It's easier to, on the production side to change the script while it's in storyboard phase because there's no storyboards anymore. You know, there's no paper storyboards. We used to get like a big package of storyboards that was like a giant, you know, thing, a giant thing of like, you know, 300 pages of storyboards we'd look at. Now it's all digital. It's all on an iPad, things like that. So it's easier for the animators to make a change, you know, without having to go through all the other stuff they used to have to do. And if we rewrite something or change something at the color stage, it's easier to make those kinds of changes. And it's also easier to record actors, you know, remotely via satellite. Occasionally, you know, back in the older days, you know, if we had a sometimes an actor who lived in New York or something like that, we'd have to fly out there and be with them.
Right.
But we don't do that as much anymore. So now it's much easier to sort of record someone remote via satellite or some kind of technological thing. I'd say as far as like my other show, F is for Family, where I'm much more involved in the production because I'm the head writer and showrunner
right.
of that. So I'm always like looking at cuts that are being doing them on the internet. They're being sent up. You know, we have a system called the PIX system, which I can just log into and watch an episode from anywhere on my phone or anything like that. You know, before that, you couldn't do that. You had to like watch it on a VHS tape.
Yeah, they'd have to send you the tape, or you'd have to go into the office or whatever and watch the tape.
Right. So now it's very easy to do it from anywhere in the world almost. So, and we'll end up having like these kind of giant conference calls with our animation studio is in Montreal. So we'll have like a big conference call. We're all watching it together, and I'm able to sort of scroll through the episode, and we're all remotely logged in. So it's that certainly has changed.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So another thing that I've heard, you know, fans of the show conjecture is that South Park and Family Guy kind of put pressure on the show to be a little bit more timely with its references, you know, both in terms of cultural references and political references. Is that something that you found true, you know, kind of over the last decade of working on the show?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I can't imagine. I don't remember an actual everyone saying, oh, we've got to do this because of this or because of this.
Right.
Show. I do think, though, I mean, it's interesting. My time at the show started, my very first day working on the show was like right around Christmas time of 2001. So, you know, it was right after 9/11, you know, it was the Bush years. And I think just naturally because of what was going on at that time, you know, the Iraq war and all that stuff, it felt right for us to come up with episodes or at least jokes within episodes that reference what was going on in the world. So I don't think it particularly was sort of a reaction to, let's say, a South Park or a Family Guy. It was just a general direction that we all kind of went in together. A lot of us had very similar feelings about what was going on in the world at the time. So I think we found it was interesting.
Well, and also, I mean,
this compelled to sort of do something about it, to say something about it in our small, you know,
right,
cartoon way.
And I mean, The Simpsons is at a certain level, it's like an institution, right? It's, you know, we don't have to change what is the core of what this show is because something else is concurrently successful.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the first episode you wrote, or at least the first episode that you were credited on, and I know that, you know, the way these things work is not all linear. You probably have contributed to other episodes, but the first one you were credited with is My Mother, the Carjacker, which Yes. is really a lot less episodic. And actually it has, you know, a strict tie-in to the continuity of the show. So when an episode is theoretically going to change the world that The Simpsons live in, and the best episodes I can think of related to that are the Armin Tanzarian episode, which a lot of fans do not like. That's right. A very dirty word to a lot of Simpsons fans. and then Maude Flanders passing. What is that process like? You know, does Matt Groening have to sign off? Is the showrunner realizing, you know, they're taking a risk with this? Kind of how does the continuity conversation happen in the office?
Yeah, well, I wasn't around for those other two, for Tamzarian show and the Maude Flanders. Although I'm a big fan of the Armin Tamzarian show.
It's a funny episode.
Yeah, it was very funny. I mean, I at the time when it aired, I was just a guy. I mean, I was working on other shows. I was a working comedy writer. But I just watched it, and I thought it was hilarious. And the thing that I loved about it was the thing at the end where Judge Snyder makes everyone swear, you know, we will never mention this ever again. And that was a great way to sort of reset everything, the Simpson style. So I remember being somewhat surprised when I came over here and to find out that the degree of, you know, that some people didn't like it that much. But I'm okay with it. But, you know, as far as the mother show, I mean, certainly Matt is involved in, Matt is aware of every episode. So if he doesn't want us to do something like that, you know, he will make it, he will make his views known, you know, because every episode goes through Matt and also goes through Jim Brooks, as well as Al, you know, and Matt Selman, our two showrunners. But, you know, I think that one was just, I want to give all credit to Al for that episode too, because, you know, like you said, that was the first show I was credited with, but I had been working there almost a year before I got to write that script. And it was a long learning process. It was, you know, I was a fan of the show when I started working here, but I wasn't probably as much of a fan of it as maybe, you know, you are right now, or, you know, like such an intimate knowledge of it. Cause I knew it was a great show. I didn't watch it every week. You know, half a year would go by before I saw episodes or I'd catch them on reruns. So I wasn't intimately involved in the show. So it took me a while to sort of learn all the characters and the style, you know, how to write for certain characters and what kind of show it is. And so I was trying to pitch stories to get through to write one, and nothing I came up with went through, nothing. And to Al's credit, you know, he wants everyone on staff to get to write at least one script every season.
Every season,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, so he said, well, here's one. How about this? He goes, what if he so that basically the story idea for that episode was Al's, about Homer's mother coming back from being on the run and them reuniting. And then, you know, we worked on it. Then once we got together, then we worked on it. We worked the story out together, and I wrote the first draft of the script. And then, of course, when you write a first draft of the script, that's just what it is. It's a first draft, and then it's then worked on with everyone, you know, for quite a long time. We do many, many drafts of every episode, punching it up and rewriting it. So when that episode got on TV, I think the only thing from my original draft that made it all the way through was a bit where there's a thing where it's called, gets a mysterious cryptic message, you know, meet me at this place. And he goes there, and then he has a little flashlight, and he gets scared, and he sees a scary thing. He goes, ah, and then he sees another thing, ah, and then he shines his flashlight on a billboard for the Pep Boys, Manny Moe and Jack, or our version of them. He goes, ah, ah, ah. That was my only joke from my original.
That's the only one that stuck from the script.
That's the only one that made it all the way through.
No, I was ready to compliment you on a different joke, because there's a very hilarious joke at the end of that script where Homer sees "I'm okay" as a message in the newspaper, and then he misses that there's a much longer message in an article about, well, it's about some food thing that Homer obviously should have wanted to read, and it's much longer explaining how his mom is not actually dead.
Well, that came about, that bit came about, I had a hand in that. That was all part of the rewrite. Yeah, we came up with that thing where it says, I am okay. And there's this giant thing about how she got away from her fake death. And then she went to like a apple contest or something. Whatever.
Something like, yeah, right, I don't remember exactly.
So, yeah, but I mean, I was certainly involved in that, but it wasn't part of my original script.
So I went to school to major in English, and some of the listeners of the show really like to make fun of me about that, because I don't always have the best grammar in these episodes, but I did always want to write in some form or fashion. And, you know, kind of, it's very different in 2019. You know, a lot of people who go to school for writing, for art, a lot of them end up working in TV instead of, you know, the more classical mediums of, you know, just creative outlet, whether that be writing or art or film. So, you know, did you know that you always wanted to be a writer, and how did you, you know, end up choosing writing for TV as opposed to another medium?
Well, I think I always knew that I loved TV.
So, sure. Yeah. That's a good place to start.
Growing up as a kid, I grew up in the New York area, New York, New Jersey area, in the pre-cable days, where there were like six TV channels, the three networks, and there were three independent stations that just played old movies and old cartoons and everything. And I just loved them. I especially love comedy. I love watching old, like Bugs Bunny cartoons, and also old comedy movies like The Marx Brothers and W.C. Fields and that kinds of thing. So, and then when I got older, like when I was more in like high school age, I got into like Monty Python and Second City TV and Saturday Night Live, and just thinking that was great, but still never had idea that could be a thing that you could possibly do. And the first time I saw a script for something was in the early years of Saturday Night Live. They put out a companion book that I think you could still find like on eBay. It was right the first or second season of Saturday Night Live when it was such a big new thing. And in it, they had reprints of some of the sketches in their script format. I was like, wow, this is what the script is. This is how it looks, you know. But I still didn't quite know what to do about it. And I was a theater person. So I was a theater major in college with an English minor. So there you go. But
there we go.
And I went to graduate school for theater. And after graduate school, I came back. I grew up in New Jersey, came back to New Jersey, and got involved in putting together a theater company with some of my friends from college. I didn't know how that would translate into actually, you know, earning a living, because I had all the other kind of like survival type day jobs. And then I got involved in doing improv and sketch comedy in New York City with a group in New York City called Gotham City Improv. That's still there. And that was a place where you did improv theater type games and exercises, but then that led you to write. So it would be kind of like you do like an improv and come up with something goofy, and the teacher would say, okay, that goofy idea that you came up with the improv, go home and write a sketch around that now, or go home and write a monologue for the character that you came up with on the fly. And so it taught me and the rest of us there how to take, you know, something, a spark or something that came about sort of spontaneously, but then to go home and turn it into craft, like craft it into something. So that was kind of my like boot camp in a way for learning how to write comedy sketches and also how to write dialogue and how to write characters. And then from that, I got involved with a person. We became writing partners and we wrote a bunch of sketches together, and we ended up turning that into like our own two-person show in New York. And some people thought we were good and said, you should come out and, you know, showcase it in Los Angeles. And by that point, it was like, there was not much going on in terms of the TV industry in New York.
Yeah.
Except for Saturday Night Live. And so we came out here, and it was all out here in LA. So we came out here, sold everything, drove a car across the country with like just a little bit of money saved, and just started knocking on doors. And it took a while. We ended up, partnership didn't last that long. We did a showcase where we got some people who saw us, and from that we got an agent. But our partnership didn't last, and so I stuck it out. And thank God I had an agent, which is the hardest thing to get. And I just wrote a bunch of scripts. So you write a bunch of what's called spec scripts, which, you know, are like samples of existing shows. And I wrote a ton of those. And after another couple of years of like doing crazy survival jobs, like I drove a taxi cab and I worked for like phone.
Yeah, you grinded.
I did like phone, yeah, boiler room type things, telemarketing. I finally got a job on a low budget sketch comedy show, which then I met some people there who then helped me get another job on an animated show with Nickelodeon called Real Monsters. And from that, I then met another guy, and you meet people, and if you're good and you get along well with other people on the staff, then hopefully, you know, as it worked out with me, someone recommends you for this or that. And, you know, I eventually started getting more and more work. And then the story I always tell, which is, well, I'll try to make it long story short, is that my very first sitcom job on a primetime show was the show on the old UPN network, which is now...
The PJs.
No, actually, it was called Homeboys in Outer Space.
Oh, even better.
This was in 1996. So it was a show that was only lasted one season. It's on that list of, like, you know, everyone's list of, like, worst shows of all time. it was really fun to work on. But on that show, it was produced by Disney. I met Al Jean and Mike Reese, who were at the time had an overall development deal with Disney Studios to create shows. And they worked one day a week on Homeboys in Outer Space. And I got to know them and they liked me. That very next year, they created their own show for ABC called Teen Angel. And they hired me for that. I worked with them a couple more times on a couple other things here and there, including the PJs. And then eventually they went back to The Simpsons, and Mike kind of semi-retired. Al stayed on full time, became the showrunner of The Simpsons again. And about a year after that, I was working on a show called What About Joan, that starred Joan Cusack. And I got a call from Al saying, you know, we have an opening here at The Simpsons if you're available. And as it turned out, I was on the verge of being available because that show was close to getting canceled, and it did get canceled. And then I got a job at The Simpsons. And that's how that all worked out.
A tale as old as time. That is, yeah. That's it does feel like there are definitely a lot of people who moved west to LA to do something creative in, you know, the 80s and the 90s, and some people were really successful, and you know, there are probably a lot of people who came west when you did and were not nearly as successful.
I'm sure. I mean, I feel very, very fortunate. I mean, of course, I believe in myself. I believe that I have talent and that, you know, I could produce the stuff and write good stuff. But so much of it is based on circumstance. You know, if I hadn't worked on Homeboys in Outer Space, if I'd gotten a job on God knows whatever other show, who knows? I would never have met Alan Mike. I wouldn't have done this or that. You never know. So, and that's why I tell people, young people who are starting out, like, you know, take it. If you get a chance to work on something, it may not be the greatest thing ever. It may not be what you wanted to do, but take it. You know, you never know what show is going to be
what will come next.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. So I'm really glad that I didn't have a choice. It was like I wasn't going to turn my nose down at a job.
It's like, yeah, I got to eat too.
Yeah, right. Also. Yeah. So I was thrilled, and it was a great job. It was a great. I had so much fun on that show. I'm still friends with so many of the people who worked on that show. But that's really what led to The Simpsons.
So you also consulted on the Simpsons movie, who many fans of the show have pretty conflicted feelings about. I love it, you know, the same way I still am going to watch, you know, season 31 of the show. How do you feel about the movie now? We are a decade on from the Simpsons movie, and kind of what was your role in, you know, consulting in its creation?
That's a great question. I love the movie. I mean, it was a really interesting time here, because it took a long time to get it started for various reasons, something to do with like putting contracts together for everybody to work on it. And so they'd have been on the work for a while. My first experience with it was knowing that it was coming. And then we had, you know, they put together this kind of super team of all the original writers were like Al Jean, Mike Reese, Mike Scully, David Merkin, John Vitti, John Swartzwelder, George Meyer. I don't want to leave anybody out, but it was like this giant super team of all the great writers, you know, from the early years of the show, who then worked on the first draft. And then they had a table read of it that we all got to watch and see. And it was like, wow, this is great. We loved it. It was all there. The dome and all that stuff was there. And then it went into production, and most of the production, you know, as they, you know, make what are called animatics and things like that, you know, things changed. They reconvened the room. They added some other writers to the room. Matt Selman, Ian Maxtone Graham joined the writing team of the main room. And then as it came down to be about like, I want to say around 6 or 7, 8 months before the movie came out, they drafted myself, Joel Cohen, Tim Long, and John Frink to be kind of what we called like ourselves, like the upstairs room or the modular room or the little satellite room. And all we had to do was a couple of days a week while the big guys were working downstairs in their own room, really wrestling over like big picture items, like the story, the direction of the story or major scenes. We were tasked with coming up with like individual jokes here and there. So for instance, there's one thing where Homer is pulled over while they're driving to Alaska, I believe. And he gets pulled over by a police officer. And he take out his driver's license. So there's a bit in the movie where you see him go through his wallet, and there's like three other funny things in his wallet. One of them is a picture of Michael Jordan with Homer's head taped over Michael Jordan. So that's the kind of stuff we came up with. We came up with like 100 of those. Like, what is in Homer's wallet? And we sent those down, and they picked the three or four that they like best. One other thing that we worked on was that the Albert Brooks's character called Russ Cargill was originally a much different character. He looked different. And he was kind of like a sad sack, kind of hunched over, like bureaucrat guy who was not very, kind of a grumpy, low energy guy.
Well, and here's the thing about Russ Cargill. It should have just been Mr. Burns, right?
Well, yeah, I don't know. Albert Brooks.
I'm not trying to get you in trouble, but that has been my opinion of the movie.
I grant you that. But I thought as it was, it turned out great because Albert Brooks is a genius. So, but then they changed the character to be much more of an Hank Scorpio-ish, you know, Albert's mouth guy. And that made it much better. And so the one thing that of his that we came up with is the thing when he says, I want 1,000 tough guys and 1,000 soft guys, you know, and I want this way, tough, soft. That was us. So we came up with like little things like that. And then we'd send them downstairs and we'd hear later, oh, they like this one or like that one. So that was my extent of the work on the movie. But it was fun. It was fun. I still enjoy it.
Yeah, very very cool stuff. So we are running a little bit low on time here, but I did want to talk about your show on Netflix, F is for Family. Yes. I think the biggest change in definitely my lifetime. I'm 27, so the biggest thing has been just the change from network programming to streaming services. You know, so much original content now is coming from streaming services. So you have worked on both sides. What is the biggest difference in writing and producing streaming content versus network programming?
Well, you know, working for Netflix has been really great. It's a different animal, mostly because, well, the money is a little bit less. Our budget is a little bit less on F is for Family than on The Simpsons. But But mostly it's in the in two things, in the kind of storytelling, which is Netflix really, when we first brought our show, we first envisioned our show, myself and Bill Burr and our producing partners, Peter Billingsley and Vince Vaughn, we thought of it originally as more of a Simpsons type show in terms of like storytelling, in terms of episodes, where it would just be, you know, it would be an episode at a time and it wouldn't necessarily have to have any kind of arc or serialization. And but around the time that we brought it to Netflix, and this was right when Netflix was just really starting out, like we first brought it to Netflix was around this time of year, 2013. So I think all they had on the air at that time maybe was House of Cards. They had that show called Lilyhammer with Steve Van Zandt. And I think like BoJack and things like that were in the works, but they weren't on there yet. So so they told us, they picked us up. They said, we want you to make six episode first season. And they said, we want you to do, you know, this kind of serialized or like binge watching, you know, style of storytelling where story arcs develop and each episode leads to the next. And at first we were kind of thrown by it and we were like, oh my God, how are we going to do this? And, but then once we really just put our heads to it and started embracing it, it made all the difference in the world. And now I can't imagine the show any other way. So that's one certain way of doing it. But then the other part of it is that it takes so long to make the show and for a season to come out because Netflix wants to release all our episodes at once. So now our you know, we're currently producing season four right now, which will be out sometime early next year. And, you know, a couple episodes are already finished. So if this was the Simpsons style or any other network, you know, episode one probably could be out right now. But because we're Netflix and Netflix releases all 10 episodes at once, we can't put the show out until all 10 are finished. And that won't be until, you know, early next year. So that's part of it too. But and then but the third thing is it's incredibly freeing. You know, we're free from, you know, commercial TV in terms of, you know, network standards and practices. You know, we're not worrying about, you know, displeasing an advertiser or this or that, you know, so we don't get, we get zero, almost zero notes from the network in terms of what we can say or can't say or do, have the characters say or do. So we're incredibly free to, you know, our show is certainly very adult in its, you know, its dialogue and it's sort of foul mouth and you see some nudity and notable male nudity and things like that. So, you know, in a way that could ever be shown on Fox or the major networks. So, I mean, if Netflix or didn't exist, then there's no way the show could have ever been done. So I'm so glad that it does and we're able to do it for them.
Yeah, it is very, and if you guys have not watched the show, it is, I started watching some of it before you and I hopped on here, and it is very funny, and I would recommend it. So the last thing I want to ask you before we let you go is, you know, do you have any big opinions on the future of television as it pertains to, you know, cord cutting and these massive corporations, you know, kind of going to battle with the TV networks? You know, there are so many different types of streaming services now. Kind of how do you see all of this playing out? Or do you even have an opinion?
Well, I have an opinion. I don't know. I can't know if they can make a prediction or not. I mean, I remember, it's so funny, about 20 years ago, I was working on that show called The PJs. And this was when it was the beginning of reality shows starting to come on and do really well. Like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and Survivor and things like that. And I remember one of the writers on that show saying, basically, in 5 years, none of us will have work. None of us will have jobs. TV will be over. There will be no more need for comedy writers. You know, so he was wrong. But
thank goodness. You know?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, no one could have predicted back then what this would be like. I remember we went on we had a strike. A writer's strike around this time of year in 2007 that ran from 2007 to 2008. I think that's what it was. Yeah. So that was 11 years ago, 12 years ago. Even then, you know, they were talking about, we were on strike to hope to get coverage for what were then going to be called like webisodes or internet programming. You know, we thought it would be like, you know, you do like a web episode of a existing series. The whole thing of streaming and Netflix and Hulu and Amazon, that was, I certainly didn't anticipate that. So what's going on right now from a viewing standpoint, it's pretty exciting because there's so much stuff. It's almost too much in a way.
Yeah. There's just a constant deluge of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, like this week, I mean, there's like three different things coming on that I can't wait to see. Hopefully like The Mandalorian and Disney Plus and all that stuff. From the point of view of someone like me, you know, who's in the business, who's a writer, right now it feels like the kind of the Wild West where there's like so much stuff going on out there. There's so much opportunity to bring things, to bring ideas, to get shows made, that it feels like at least for the next, I don't know, year or two or so, because everyone's, all these, like you're saying, all these major corporations are, like Apple has their service, which just started running, and Disney's is coming next week. And then Warner Brothers has HBO Max, and then NBC has theirs, and CBS has theirs, and Hulu, and Amazon, and everybody. You know, I think they're all gonna keep making stuff for a while, and like it's kind of like this crazy, like arms race, and you know, it'll shake out eventually, and probably contract at some point. But right now, it seems like for someone who works in the business as a writer, you know, it seems like there's like endless opportunities and there's lots of things being made. So I welcome that.
Yeah. Well, Michael, thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it. I thought that was a very illuminating conversation.
Oh, thanks. I had a great time. Thank you.
Yeah. Everyone, please make sure check out F is for Family on Netflix. If you guys reach out to me on Twitter, I can send you the episode list that Michael has contributed on for The Simpsons, as I copied and pasted that for our agenda here. Go ahead.
Sorry, if I could just make one more quick plug. We have a couple of great episodes coming up on The Simpsons too. I'm glad you watch it in season 31. We're also a show. We have a very special episode coming up the Sunday before Thanksgiving, which I can't say enough about how much I love this episode. It's written by Dan Weber, produced by Matt Selman, and it's like a Halloween horror trilogy, except they're all Thanksgiving stories. So I think it's even called Thanksgiving of Horror, but it's like an extra special, an additional horror trilogy beyond our Halloween show, which we just did, but they're all stories set at Thanksgiving, and we have Thanksgiving names, everything. I think it's gonna be great. So that's on the 24th, I think, which is the Sunday before Thanksgiving. So don't miss
that. We go. That is something to look forward to. Mike, thanks so much for the time.
Sure. Thank you, Davis.